Mr. Smith, and I think we can get underway. The next case is Clark against Experian Information, 063330. Mr. Smith.
May it please the Court, my name is James Smith, and I represent the appellants. For the reasons stated in our brief, we request that this Court reverse the District Court's order granting defendants' motion for summary judgment, as well as reversing their order denying plaintiffs' motion for class certification. And today I'm only going to address one large issue that I believe affects both the summary judgment and the class certification. And that one large issue is the analysis that the District Court took in determining whether the disclosure at issue in this case was deceptive. The analysis that the District Court took was improper, and I believe it was error, and that error affected their decision with summary judgment as well as class certification. Now, as you know, at issue here is a free credit report that consumers can purchase online. And when they purchase that free credit, or when they order their free credit report online, they're also obligated to order a credit check monitoring service. And with respect to that credit check monitoring service, they have it free for 30 days. And if they don't cancel it in 30 days, they're obligated to pay $79.95. And they'll have to pay that fee every year from then on unless they decide to cancel. And it's important that this is a free credit report that's being offered, because the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act regulates companies' marketing plans with respect to free products and free services. Specifically, what the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act states is that if a company is going to use a free product or free service, they have to clearly and conspicuously disclose all disclosures, and they have to do it in the onset of the transaction. The District Court didn't take that analysis into consideration, and we respectfully argue that that was an error. Additionally, if the District Court did take that analysis into consideration, we believe that they would have come to the conclusion that, in fact, defendant's motion for summary judgment should have been denied. Specifically, the disclosure in this instance is several pages into the transaction. It's after the consumer has to enter in their credit card information. It's underneath a category that says privacy policy notice. And immediately, there's one sentence that discloses that they have an obligation of paying $79.95 if they do not cancel. And immediately after that one sentence, there's another sentence in bold, such that as a consumer drifting down the page with their eyes, they jump to the bolded sentence, is what bolded language is supposed to be. And we argue here today, Your Honors, that that's a far, far away from clear and conspicuous disclosure.
Well, and certainly that language that's there, the language in the on the web page showed that one could cancel at any time during the free membership period.
That's correct, right? Your Honor.
And the idea that one would have to provide a credit card certainly suggests also that there might have to be payment, and that was that $79.95.
That's also correct, Your Honor.
So what's your strongest evidence that Mr. Eldred was actually deceived by this?
Well, the strongest evidence is that the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, the Illinois legislature, is taken into these free product, free services marketing plans into consideration and added it to their statute stating that the reasonable consumer needs a disclosure to be clear and conspicuous.
What's the evidence that he was actually deceived by this?
That Mr. Eldred was actually deceived. Mm-hmm. That the disclosure was not clear and conspicuous pursuant to what the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act requires. What they could have done with the disclosure is put it on the front page where they write free credit report and no obligation. They didn't. They put it several pages into it. They put it underneath a category that says private policy notice, which doesn't seem to indicate that there's going to be language in there indicating that you're going to have to make a payment.
No, but I'm trying to get to what Eldridge, you know, how he was deceived, because when you look at his deposition and what he said, when he was asked whether he'd read the language about whether he could cancel at any time during the membership period, he said he couldn't remember whether he did it or not. He couldn't say whether he had seen it or not, that he didn't know. I mean, isn't that problematic for you, you know, because you can't show that he was deceived by this language?
I don't think that's problematic, and the reason why he couldn't remember is because he didn't see it. And the reason why he couldn't see it is because it wasn't clearly and conspicuously laid out on their website, which is exactly what the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act is there to protect. consumers like Mr. Eldridge.
But the thing is, Eldridge couldn't say whether he saw it or not, and so therefore he couldn't say whether he understood it or was deceived by it, right?
That's correct, and thousands of consumers, and just like Eldridge, also wouldn't be able to say for sure or not because they didn't see it. It wasn't clear and conspicuous. It wasn't until the defense attorney clearly and conspicuously put it in front of him during his deposition, in which he could finally say, oh, there it is, I understand what you're telling me. That the issue here is that it wasn't clear and conspicuous. Our position is that the district court erred in looking to the plaintiff's conduct in order to determine if it was deceptive. They didn't need to do that. They needed to file the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act and look at the actual language, look at where the language was put, and that was the obligation of the district court, and we believe they erred in that. And if they would have followed that, they would have determined that defendant's motion for summary judgment should be denied. And for this similar reasons, they erred on class certification as well. The district court felt that there was too many individual issues with respect to the plaintiff's conduct, the plaintiff's state of mind, with respect to interpreting whether they saw the disclosure, whether they understood the disclosure, whether each individual consumer or each individual plaintiff was deceived. However, if you follow the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act's language, you don't look to the plaintiff's conduct. You don't look to the plaintiff's state of mind. You look at the actual disclosure. You look at it to where the disclosure is. And if you eliminate that, you eliminate any sort of individual issues that the district court were concerned of. Every issue is common, and as a result, the issues here, the common issues predominate, and motion for class certification was going to be appropriate.
If it's per se defective or deceptive, how many people, is that anybody who got this gets their money back?
The current definition with respect to the class is that all Illinois consumers that were enrolled in the credit check monitoring service and did not access the service. Of course, the definition can be changed at any time if the court deems appropriate, but that's what the definition was at the time of the motion for class certification, Your Honor.
In other words, if they didn't use it, is that accessing it, meaning that they did check at some point that what the status was of their credit?
That's correct, Your Honor. And it's my understanding that defendant's records, they're able to determine that.
And somebody who didn't check it presumably didn't know they had the right to check it?
That's correct.
Even though it was charged to them already?
That's correct. And looking at it in a vacuum, it may look that it's not as deceptive. That by itself might not be persuasive. However, when you look at some outside facts for example, the Better Business Bureau rated this company as an F because of the number of consumer complaints. The fact that the Federal Trade Commission received so many complaints that they launched their own investigation and filed their own complaint against this defendant for the same disclosures that were at issue here. Moreover, Visa had 21,000 chargebacks within a seven-month period, and Visa did their own investigation and determined that we have all these chargebacks because your disclosure is not deceptive. All of those reasons combined, we argue, is an indication that if a consumer was enrolled in this credit check monitoring service and did not access it, necessarily means that they didn't see it. They didn't know they were ordering it.
Under class action, then what would they get back? Or what would be their damages or whatever?
The damages, for example, Mr. Eldridge was charged three times. I believe he was compensated for one of those charges. So he would get that money back. Consumers that were able to find it,
he was more than 1 year.
Correct.
You mean for every year they let it go, even though they paid the annual fee, they would still be part of this class?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and as far as what they would get back, would they recover the $79 or would they recover something else?
The $79, Your Honor. In addition, the consumer info, if they cancel it within 6 months, you'd get a prorated refund. So if you were able to find it on your credit card statement, 40 days later or 60 days later, the consumer would still be hit with hypothetically, a $695 charge, and that consumer would be entitled to that money back.
And apparently with all of these Visa complaints, there must have been some chargebacks or repercussion somewhere through that avenue also, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. There are consumers undoubtedly that received full refunds, and they don't have damages and they won't be a part of this class. But we represent thousands of consumers that did receive a damage and that they should be compensated for the deceptive disclosure. So, Your Honors, with the arguments as we laid out in our briefs and what I mentioned today, we respectfully request that you reverse the district court's granting of defendant's motion for summary judgment and the denial of plaintiff's motion for class certification, and remand this case to a different judge. If you have no other questions, I'll sit.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We'll hear now from Mr. Fetter.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Mayor Fetter. I represent the defendants here. And I think that the plaintiff's focus on this one big issue is correct in a limited sense, in that it is that one issue that, disposes of both of the issues on appeal. The plaintiff is continuing to take the position that it's enough to show that some standard of clarity of disclosure hasn't been met and that that's enough to establish a claim, but this is directly contrary to a whole series of Illinois Supreme Court decisions that all of them decided in the last 10 years that have made it clear that a plaintiff under the Act has to prove, to establish the proximate cause element of the claim, that the plaintiff was actually deceived. And in this case, the failure to establish that Mr. Eldred was actually deceived based on his testimony at his deposition in the absence of any other evidence is what disposes of the case for summary judgment purposes. And on the class certification issue, the need to establish for each individual plaintiff that the plaintiff was actually deceived is what led the district court to properly find that the individual issues that would be that the court would be required to go into to establish that for each class member meant that the common issues did not predominate and a class action was not appropriate here. We think that determination was correct, but it certainly was well within the scope of the district court's broad discretion on ruling on a class action motion. And so, as I say, the fact that there is this requirement of proving actual deception for each plaintiff is dispositive of both issues in the case.
Under Illinois law, what does it usually take to prove actual deception?
Well, this has come up in a series of cases that have held that that actual deception had not been properly pleaded or proved. So the Illinois Supreme Court cases at issue, which are Price versus Philip Morris, Avery, Zechman, Oliveira, and Shannon, none of them has said, to my recollection, that such and such is sufficient, but there would be could be any of a number of things that would do it. Direct testimony by the plaintiff is certainly one of the things that would be relevant evidence in proving that. But at a minimum, the plaintiff would have to put in some competent evidence based on which a jury could find that he or she actually was deceived by the defendant's representations and that that was the cause of their entering into the transaction at issue.
For those who discovered this on their credit card charge and then complained, did they generally get their money back, even if it was after 30 days?
My understanding is that they would get a prorated refund, but I think that there are also situations where, for example, one of the plaintiffs here, Ms. Clark, I think, had that situation and received a prorated refund and then got the rest of the money back from her credit card company, which in turn charged it back to the company, so that ultimately she got a full refund. As the plaintiffs have pointed out, there also was a consent agreement with the FTC under which there were refunds that were provided to some customers, I believe customers who, at least some of them, who were in that situation. So, I mean, I don't want to be in the position of testifying here as to exactly what the company policy was.
Well, it's a lot of rigmarole for $79. Everybody going through all these meanders. I'm just curious what all involves and what it takes to get it back under these circumstances, whether anybody bothers to do it.
Well, I think that the record made clear that people do bother to do it. And, in fact, there was something in the record suggesting that very large numbers of people had done what many people will do in a situation like this, which is sign up for the free trial period, get their free credit report, and then cancel within the trial period.
A lot of people read the whole thing then.
Yes, and but of course, even the people who didn't do that doesn't mean that they didn't read the whole thing, because sometimes, you know, I won't speak from personal experience, but certainly as a consumer, one can see an offer like that and decide, you know, this is good, I can get it for free, and I just have to cancel, and then people may not get around to canceling, or may decide, you know, this is a service I may want to keep, or may have decided in the first place, obviously, that this was a service that they wanted to have monitoring their credit to protect against identity theft. So there are a whole host of reasons why someone would sign up and then not cancel. One of the things that's interesting, actually, in Mr. Eldred's deposition here is that at one point he said that it's possible that he himself had signed up and then called back the next day to cancel, Consumer Info couldn't prove that he hadn't done that. And that, of course, would suggest that if he's saying that that's a possibility, he's not even taking the position that he really knows whether he understood at the time that this was something that he was signing up for that had to be canceled if he didn't want to continue it. So, you know, that is something that, you know, obviously it's a type of marketing that is controversial, but it is something where in order to get the free credit report, people do take on the obligation to cancel their trial membership if they don't want to continue in it, and that is what many people did. But in any event, under Illinois law, in order to satisfy the private cause of action, I should point out that the requirements of that are separate from the elements that the government would have to meet in order to establish a violation under the Act, because this actual deception requirement is something that comes out of the proximate cause requirement, which applies only to private actions. So the Attorney General, for instance, would not have that provision applying to an action by the Attorney General, and that's something that can be enforced independent of the proximate cause requirement. If there are no further questions, rest on our brief.
Thank you, Mr. Fetter. Does Mr. Smith have some time left? Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Your Honors. I have just one quick point to make. What counsel just stated is accurate, that this is controversial marketing. It's a controversial marketing plan, and that's exactly why the Illinois legislature included it in the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act. And that's exactly why the plaintiffs don't have to individually prove that they're actually deceived, because the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act already has laid out the standards, and if the companies don't meet these standards, reasonable consumers will be deceived. If you have that standard and then you go out and force consumers, reasonable consumers, to then prove that they were in fact deceived, you'd be taking the teeth away from the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, which is the entire basis of our arguments, Your Honors. And unless you have further questions, you know, we'll rest on our briefs.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel in the case, and the case will be taken under advisement.